tuned into Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Tune in right now.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? My beautiful people out there. Happy Thursday. It's your boy, Danny Royce. We are here, another episode inside the Black Actors Studio. I have an amazing guest with me today. You've seen him on Stump the Yard, Howard High, Monogamy, Bronx SIU. The list goes on and on. I can do bad all by myself. We got so much to talk about. He is the president of The On Channel, an awesome new streaming platform. Got a lot to talk about, like I said. Please welcome the Black Actors Studio. Is very proud to have Brian J. White. What's good, man? How are you?
I'm well. How are you today? Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm blessed. I'm here. I'm alive. I'm Rona free. I'm just living my best
life. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We're all blessed to be healthy, sniffle free, alive, yes. And all that. So God bless.
Yes. Yes, sir. And I thank you so much for taking the time to join me here. You know, obviously we can't be in person, but this is just as good. So thank you for giving me your time today. And I want to start off by congratulating you. I mean, you got a lot to talk about. You're doing a lot. Hustler is a hashtag hustler, right? We're gonna talk about that later on. What's that?
Hashtag hustle story.
Hustle story. There you go. Congratulations on The On Channel. Okay, so just give us a little brief story about how you got into that streaming platform.
I've been raised to aspire to be an executive all my life. You know, from both my grandmothers and grandfathers, both sides were executives. They owned companies. They were business owners. Wow. They replicated those. My grandmother from the 1930s was showing me pictures of, she owned mortuaries, and my grandfather passed, my mother's father. And so my grandmother, as a single Black woman in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, had to operate multiple mortuaries in Topeka, Kansas, as a single woman with three daughters. And she had a fleet of Cadillacs, owned a movie theater, a golf course. Things that, you know, you don't think of a single Black woman with three children in the 30s and 40s and 50s being able to do in Topeka, Kansas. And so, you know, she taught my sisters and I what goes into replicating her success. And I was offered the opportunity to be involved with The On Channel through Chief Content Officer Brookshire Lafayette, and expressed to him I'd always wanted to be the president of a studio and make a difference, a generational shift in the way things are done, the kind of opportunities that are available to people that look like us and yourself. And blessed me, and Maurice Woodson blessed me with the opportunity to be involved with him in helping steer The On Channel, and here we are.
Nice. Yeah, no, I want to talk a little bit more about that later on in the episode. But first, as always, we like to start off from the beginning. Where were you born?
Boston, Massachusetts, Danvers, Melrose Hospital, I think. right outside Boston, Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, nice. And so how was the dynamics and the family dynamics growing up?
I'm the only boy, the eldest. I have five younger sisters.
Wow.
Is a
a lot of women in there.
A lot of estrogen, very little testosterone, my brother.
Wow.
Yeah, so you're the eldest. The only boy, the eldest. My dad was a Hall of Fame basketball player. White for the Boston Celtics. Cousin Chris Chambliss, a famous Yankee, Hall of Fame Yankee. I played sports, professional football, lacrosse, before becoming an entertainer and an entrepreneur. And
did you during playing sports, like, did you aspire to be like your dad or anything? Like, did you see that being your future?
I mean, once you get signed, I played for the Patriots, played for the Boston Blazers. Once you sign and you're playing in that kind of a situation, you kind of feel like you're in the game, so to speak, as far as getting to the big dance. As far as ever wanting to be a basketball player, my game's just not good enough. I was a great defender. I'm 6'2", I'm 6'1¾". My dad was 6'4", and even he, you know, could have used an extra 2-3 inches in today's game. So my arms aren't especially long, you know, like as a defensive football player, somebody like Deion Sanders is my same height, but his arms are like twice as long as mine. So to cover somebody and bump and run and do those things, he's physically gifted. Rajon Rondo, his arms are like a 7-foot man's arms. Right. So if he can do with the basketball or just palm it, you're like, but he's shorter than me. How's he doing that? It's just how the way he's built. And, exactly. I, you know, basketball wasn't my forte. I liked a little bit more contact. And my dad always said, you know, march to your own beat. And so football and lacrosse were my thing. And so I felt, you know, where I was supposed to be when I was doing that. I felt right at home, and my dad encouraged it.
Nice. Yeah, fellow football player, loved it. What position did you play, you said?
Defensive back. I was a corner in college. And then when I got to the pros and everybody turned it up a speed, I ended up being a strong safety and being about 203 pounds.
Hey, a little heavier back then.
Oh, yeah.
So what was when you did you have any like nicknames growing up? Did they call you anything?
I was called the Wiz most of my life. That was my college nickname. I was named that twice. I got it in high school, and it was because of Nobody Beats the Wiz, the story. And I was a defensive back, and Nobody Beats the Wiz. And then in college, it came back because my college coach, actually, I think I got the story reversed. It was Art Cajoy, my high school coach, that asked me if I ever knew who Wizza White was. He was a famous player back in the day, and knew my high school coach, and he said I reminded him of his playing style, and he used to call me Wizza. And then in college I was called the Wiz because of Nobody Beats the Wiz, and that was my fraternity brother Adam Shear, I think, gave me that shout out.
Yeah, that went for a turn that I didn't expect. I was like, the Wiz, where are you going with that? No.
Yeah, no, it wasn't about dancing. I mean, I did ballet, I had some quick feet, but that wasn't the Dorothy and Oz and all that.
Great. So what were some of the films and TV shows you watched growing up? I know some people, this is what they want to do, you know, since they were born, you know, and then some people it just kind of falls on them, you know, you got that head shaking right now, you're like, is it following me? So talk to us a little bit about that, like what you liked watching growing up, and then how did this just fall on you like that?
Oddly, I believe that, you know, we all are where we're supposed to be, not necessarily where we've always dreamed to be.
Yeah.
I'm from Boston, Massachusetts, a blue collar town. Everybody learns how to run a business, how to operate your own bank account, how wealth works as a system. It's a very education based town, school oriented town. 99.9% of my school and all schools around it graduated, went to college on time, graduated college and got a job by the age of 26, owned their house by the age of 27. Yes, that's Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And ironically, a lot of the top entertainers, let's say John Krasinski is 1 year behind me from my high school. Eli Roth is one class ahead. That's the executive producer of Baywatch, and Jack Ryan. Our rival high school is Chris Evans, who's Captain America. And then there's maybe 30 other people from the school that are notable names like that. You know, there's a hierarchy, a totem pole in Hollywood, and those are higher rungs than where I am. You know, I'm pretty high, but that's the top. And it's because they're content owners. They write scripts. They license the IP. And they're incredibly talented, whether it's directing, acting, whatever. But that's not what matters, ever. You know, George Clooney has money because he owns the IP, you know, not because he looks good on a camera and has an Oscar. He has the Oscar that matters. He owns that script and the production company that made it and financed it. And so that's what in Boston, we were busy as kids learning about those things. I wanted to be a lawyer, a judge, a doctor. Really started to focus in on wanting to be a lawyer because I like to argue. And an athlete because that seemed attainable because of my family. As far as acting, you asked me about content. Spencer for Hire and Avery Brooks was somebody that was huge because they shot that series in Boston. So he was somebody driving around as a kid that you would see. And played Hawk. He played a really cool character that wore these sunglasses and had this, you know, so it was like, I could be him when I grew up, but I actually wanted to be Hawk. I didn't want to be Avery the actor because I didn't think that was a job that somebody could have.
Right.
And then I saw Denzel on St. Elsewhere. Back when Howie Mandel was an incredible, you know, actor and not, you know, a personality comedian and host.
Right.
And, then I started to dream about being the doctor, you know, not the actor Denzel. And it wasn't until I was in college and started doing ballet and theater that I even thought, because I can't sing, I think when I was a kid, musical theater was the way you got into theater or the acting world. And I'm not a big singer. I can dance. Right. But unless I could be one of the three leads in the Grease show or whatever the play was, West Side Story that they were doing, I didn't want to be in the background. I'd rather be on the field where I thought I could be the, you know, in the spotlight more as a young man than you know, doing that. So I think that's why I never started thinking of acting or performing as an option for me until later.
Until later in life. Yeah, speaking of dancing, I mean, Stomp the Yard, right? Did you? Okay. So, I mean, that is a classic, obviously. It revolutionized. It revolutionized the dance film, okay, for sure. So tell us a little bit about how you started with that project.
Will Packer, well, a few years before, I got a call out of the blue from Patrice Fisher, who I had met not long before at an audition, and we talked about philosophy and this, that, and the third. She said, we should work together sometime. She got cast in a movie called Trois, and with Sylvain White as the director, and Reagan Preston Gomez. And I knew Reagan from sitcoms. And all of a sudden, so like the beginning of this story is, you leave a trail of breadcrumbs everywhere you go. So don't ever drop where you eat is the, you know, the saying, because it will track back to you. So these girls, you know, had really good experiences with me as a, you know, a man and a man of color in Hollywood, just socializing and working together professional. And so Patrice called and said, hey, I got a really racy script. You know, I know you are a responsible man, professional man. Check this out. The actor fell out. And the actor that they're throwing around is somebody that's not as responsible on a set as you are. And I'd rather work in this kind of a picture with you, somebody like you. And I was like, what does that mean? So I looked at the script and realized there was lots of sexy times in there. And I didn't really like that. So I gave it to my mom and my sister. Like, how... And they read it and they said, my mom said, we can make this better. You know how to write. And so I made some notes that night and I gave those back to Patrice. She took them to Sylvain and they said, you can make your notes if you come down. And I was on a plane the next day and we made Trois, then Motives, and then Stomp the Yard back to back to back. And that was when Rob Hardy and Will Pack were partners. And that's how Sylvain and I started working for them and ended up with our production company, Media 3 Films, in 2012.
Wow. That's amazing. What was one of your favorite memories on that set?
Working with Frenchie. we called Sylvain Frenchie because he's born and raised in Paris, France, and Boris Kojo, who is our other partner, born and raised in Germany.
Right.
And so as production partners, I just learned a lot from them, because when you go out to the town at that time, everybody would pitch us about what they thought the African-American market wanted in content. And the interesting thing was, Boris and Sylvain would always just be smiling and say, well, I'm French and I'm German, so you're speaking to World Black. So only one of the biggest companies African-American, so you need to speak a different way. We're a global culture, and if you're only selling one third of us, you're not making that money. And it was eye-opening to me. You know, Sylvain's a protege of Luc Besson, and Boris, you know, comes from the big German film fund world. That's a global-minded... you know, Haim Sylvain and those guys, you know, so all over the world at the biggest, highest levels are, you know, Boris's tennis buddies. And I'm learning about, you know, what's going on right now.
You know, right.
Out of Africa and working backwards, whereas we thought we were, you know, the top of the mountain. Globally, it's not that way.
Right.
That was where content, you know, comes from, and it's financed and produced. There's big Asian and Bollywood and South Korean and, you know, all these markets that were being ignored. And way back then, Sylvain and Boris were way on the pulse of where everything was going. I was just like a sponge, like a little kid trying to learn. And that's what I remember from back then. The first time I met Sylvain and the way he approached a low budget movie like Trois, and the goal visually and the goal stylistically and artistically. And I just became inspired and wanted to elevate my own game.
Right. Wow, that's awesome. You speak about, you know, a global culture, right? Which is so true, because we're everywhere, right? And so how do you think that narrative is changing in our industry to speak to our people, to speak to our community?
Well, I started out on The Parkers and Moesha.
Hey!
That's the bomb. And today,
good, I missed those shows.
and then moved on and have had a pocket several years later where I was doing a bunch of guests and recurrings on, let's say, Tyler Perry's sitcoms. Mm-hmm. And that was you know, there's a big gap between those periods. And then now it's more like Insecure and Issa Rae.
Right.
That's the evolution of the black sitcom, the African-American sitcom. That's still not going to air on the BBC.
Right.
But it's the evolution. It's the top of the food chain. It's HBO, but there's still other games. And then so Idris has Turn Up Charlie. It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
That will air on the BBC. There's not much difference, but it's very different as far as where you can sell it. And
right.
So that's, you know, it's getting closer to being the exact same thing. The quality's the same thing. It's just, you know, that's how the international markets and the buyers work globally. And, you know, if you watch the differences there and the similarities there, you have more success than if you're still trying to make Moesha 2020. You know, not that would be a bad thing or it's not hilarious. I'm sure, you know, there's lots of other shows that are that, but the ones that sell in 500 countries have turned into Insecure and
turned.
And that's the only, you know, that's the only thing that you have to learn as a distributor, what those differences are.
Right, for sure. And so you brought up Netflix, like, what are you binging now? Is there anything that you're binging during this quarantine time?
Well, I'm creating content a lot. Yeah. So absorbing the content is more a process of my job than enjoyment. You know, I'm not a huge content consumer. I don't like my daughter. She doesn't use a tablet or a phone. You know, we're more tactile learning until you have to use a computer. A computer's a tool.
And
if you learn how to work originally with your tools, then you're a slave to your tool and your tool doesn't notice you. And so, you know, she's only six. So she's just starting to get into the video aspects of it because of Corona. But as far as the mechanical, she's still writing out, you know, hash marks on a paper and being forced to do stuff the long way so her mind can see it and she can do it without the crutch.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Because that's a lot what this, you know, this generation is losing. losing track of.
I mean, it was really, you know, but as far as tools, like stuff like Art Hub, you know, where she gets to draw and we draw with her as a dad and his kids drawing, stuff where you get to participate, music lessons. I'm learning the guitar so that she can learn the guitar.
Nice.
Stuff like that, where you can come out with a practical skill rather than, you know, anytime we actually turn on a narrative show, she just turns into a zombie and you can't even comment about the narrative. You can't even have learning moments during that. It has to be before or after. So it's a very selective thing for us and for me, trying to figure out how can you create content that does have pockets where it's more interactive with kids.
Right.
Family can watch it together, because vegging out for 2 hours and then talking about stuff, their retention, if you give them a test, isn't very good, so you're not able to move the needle with them at all.
Nice. You raising a little executive of your own.
I made her make an org chart yesterday, man. It was like, what am I doing? I'm like, this is how you organize your life. So she had all these bubbles and
just, nice.
You know, her dolls were in one bubble.
That's what's up, boss status. Now I want to talk about that hat. Okay, so we talked about a little bit before. So Black Freedom, okay. It's your brand, correct? So give us a little information, like how you started the brand and what you tend to spotlight with it.
My brother Rod Foster down in Atlanta was one of the originators and partners that founded the creative concepts behind Revolt. And he then spun off into an artistic pop-up company called Alt Revolt's Dealer. They make different kinds of pop art in different kinds of format. And we were talking one day when I was down in Atlanta shooting Ambitions about connectivity and Black Wall Street and the Tenants of Power and The Secret and a lot of just deep concepts, and wanted to create a clothing brand with him that inspired Black business owners to work together. There was a clothing company that was a collaborative effort down there. The store was owned by a guy that put his brand P11 on it, but he wasn't a designer. And he just had curated a bunch of other brands, put them in a nice place, and everybody made money together, because each individually they weren't able to get the traffic they needed, but together they were able to get a lot of traffic, share it, and none of the brands
were right.
So it's like a co-op or a collective. So I sat in that store with my wife and talked for a while just about that idea and how Atlanta was a unique culture, Black Mecca, if you will, the new DC for African Americans that are sharing a lot of traffic and business. They do it a lot with social spaces, workspaces. Like, they have their own kind of WeWork spaces where you get a lot of
time.
You have a place where you can work and then socialize. And so there's a lot of benefits. that people do here at like undergrounds, you know, these $5,000 member Soho House, you know, instead it'll be Black owned in Atlanta. And you're like, okay. So it's just stringing concepts that are already working, you know, together and trying to make them work for the people a little bit more. And that is the impetus that Rod and I came to a meeting of minds of with this brand. We said, we're doing awesome. A lot of things. We started reaching out to some designers that were reaching out to me about eyeballs and said, you know what, if we create a collective, we'll do just what they did in Atlanta and share that traffic. And it just grew into a bigger thing. And now Rod's part of Snapcall doing our graphic arts there. And we're using his brand as a hustler story, how he rose up from the bottom billion with each one of us that has a side hustle and starts really small from that first customer. You know, if you're a personal trainer or me making a video for somebody on their cell phone up to now I'm getting hired to do movies, you know, you were an individual host. Now you're doing a show like this, where it's volume. You elevate from the bottom billion. You need the tools. And as you climb, stuff organically becomes easier because of the connectivity that you have. You get leverage. And that's why they call us influencers. What Snapcall, what Black Freedom are about, this is the X on the hat is the X in sign language, which is this. Mm-hmm. This is just a tool to connect. You know, mm-hmm. It still means this. But this scares people.
Yes, yes.
This is just a new way to say it. And that's what progress is. And that's what Black Freedom's about. Connect, you can read that this says Black Freedom, but it doesn't even have all the letters.
Right, exactly.
So by working in unison, you're not diminished, you're amplified. That's the message. That's the message. You can still read it, right? So all of our individual logos are right there. You can still read it. But by doing this, it just becomes that much more powerful by working together. And it takes up less space. It's much more efficient. That's the idea. If you're business minded, you get it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Definitely get that. I have to grab one of those for sure. We'll talk.
Yeah, there'll be, it's a movement. We got them available in connection with some other things. We're going to try to put them in everybody's hands. We want them everywhere.
Awesome. That's great. Well, I want to talk about Bronx SIU, okay? Because, I mean, it's coming back. Yeah. Shanti Lowry was a guest on here early in the season. And so what I know you can't talk much about what's coming forward, but as for your character, do we see any growth or can you speak upon any growth of your character and what's to come?
As one of the writers, I can say, absolutely. We're trying to deepen this story we're trying to make it an international wire, because Jimmy skirts both sides of the line. We don't know where he's going. We know that he's broken, but he's broken from trying to be good and honorable, you know, dishonorable system. And I think in the time of Rona, we're getting an insight into what a character like Jimmy would see. And what he has insights into and why he's upset. You know, if you're an ex-military man that's been deployed or woman, and then you come back and you have access to, you know, government information from being a police officer that's sent out every day and maybe not asked to wear a mask, but asked to have other people wear masks, you start to ask questions about what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's Jimmy Blue. We've seen two seasons of that. And so right now, the writer in all of us goes, there's a lot of things that he could twist out about. And that's what we're working on. And we're also trying to expand internationally because we have a built-in international storyline with China that can lead directly to Africa because China's investing in all the schools in Africa. Mr. Han has kids. So I can say that story might be explored, which leads Jimmy to a broader narrative about what's going on in the world and how crime fighters and law abiders fit in.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen and different ways things can turn. So, I mean, as a writer, I know there are writers who watch this show, and aspiring writers. What's a piece of advice you give them to just get started and then have someone believe in their work?
The way I started 20 years ago as an actor on Moesha, I started as an extra in The Best Man. The Best Man directly led to me being on Moesha within like 30 days. Once I was on Moesha, the first thing I did was audition a lot. And in auditioning a lot, I hated what I was auditioning for so much that I was like, this isn't going to, I'm not going to stay in this very long. I just came from Wall Street. I just played professional sports. It just doesn't seem that interesting. But right. I was interested in the other side of the camera, and people like Stan Lathan and Ralph Farquhar would talk to me on set about what they did. And that's really what I was interested in. I had a way to help them pay for it when I came in the door. So I immediately was interested in that. I was immediately told that those people were all writers. So I was in Starbucks, I guess, back then. They didn't have Dunkin' Donuts yet on the West Coast. And instead of napkins, I wrote a movie during my break.
Called
Wow. And I shared it with my friend Adoee, an African guy who was the story editor at New Line, which was an old big cinema house. And he was like, yo, this is crazy. And he's like, this is on... And I had the whole story, beginning, middle, and end, which is how I guess now, if I would make an outline, I always make the outline that fits on one sheet of paper. And if I can't get the story on that, it's too big. It has too many things to even sell. You know, you have to be able to pitch it in a sentence.
Right.
And so if you can't elevator pitch the outline, it's too big. So you need your synopsis, your elevator pitch, and then you write. And so I started, luckily, making the synopsis correctly on my first shot and shared it with my friend. He then helped me put it in a format so that we could solicit a writer friend that I knew that I worked on with an independent film. I just thought that this guy was had written something special. He let me read something else while we were shooting. This is the time when Adoee was reading mine, and I realized how incredible the writer guy was. And we gave him what we had, and he wrote it for us, the long version.
Right.
With me and Adoee. And then he took it to the guys that make Final Destination and American Pie and own them, Craig Perry and Warren Guy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And Craig has been my producing partner since. And Hustle got set up at CAA with Jason Statham and myself after 13 years of like everybody trying to take it from us. Literally the first time we ended up in Craig's office, he laughed for 30 minutes before he made us an offer and said, because Adoee said, when we submitted it, he said, the one thing I have to tell you we have to do, we wrote every lead for ourselves, for like me, and it, so it was an all-Black movie. And it was like $100 million all-Black heist movie. It's like The Usual Suspects. Meets the four brothers. And everybody was a brother. But Adoee's like, we have to take the character descriptions out. And I was like, why? He's like, every color's raceless. Every word stays the same, but where it says African-American, take it out. Let them imagine it. And so Craig wanted to buy the movie for full rate, thinking it was an all-white cast. And when we saw it, he goes, you guys wrote this? Adoee, Adote, and Brian White, and you're both Black. And I love you guys. You're the smartest guys I've ever met. I love this script. I love everything about it. I want to know about you. I want to work with you. Where'd you guys go to college? Harvard and Dartmouth. Warren, show them how we make money. Warren opened up his computer. He taught us, you know, a lot about finance. And Craig has been the best. Literally bar none mentor in the industry. You know, Final Destination, he wrote it, he created it, he owns a franchise. American Pie, same thing. Him and his partner, they're just the smartest people I know, the most kind people I know. And from that day forward, he was like, that's initiative, that's smart, that's humble. I want to help you guys win. And he's always been there to guide me and teach me. And it was just, that's how I got started in actually knowing what was going on as far as works in Hollywood, because he is a whale of a person and an even better man. So thank you, Craig, for sharing some little flakes of your knowledge with me in the beginning.
Shout out to Craig. Wow, what a journey. It's a marathon, you know?
Most people know him from Break-In.
Recently,
a movie that was his. He came up with that concept, and you know, he makes those kind of great movies and empowers people like Gabrielle to own a piece of what she makes, and we saw her everywhere. That's Craig.
Wow, that's amazing. I want to take this time to also to thank you again for joining me. Also, a huge shout out to Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos for allowing me to have this show and bring these awesome guests every week and share their amazing stories. You can also find the entire season one of Inside the Black Actors Studio on www.theonchannel.com. So you can binge there. You know, if you want to see it, you can see all the episodes, past episodes of season one there. We are here with Brian White. Speaking of the On Channel, what are some of the things we can expect moving forward for this platform. Because as you know, we, who knows, we might have a couple more months of this, right? So I know you guys are planning some things. I know things are getting moved around. So what can we expect moving forward from this platform?
We have a lot of exciting growth coming up. It's hard as a president, actually, when you work in a corporation. It's not my final decision on the programming. So to actually tell you what the date will be is my partner's area, but there's some interesting, what's really exciting me about On is the platform can do live things. And so there's some comedy things, there are some music things, there's an audiobook drive that we've got. Breely Evans already has a wonderful audiobook. I was blessed enough to work with her on Ambitions. We're discussing doing some interesting things because she's also a performer. There's a couple of movies that Brookshire is adding that we're trying to plan some special events around, which are unique to On. And what I mean by special events and the ability to go live are what you're seeing on social media when you watch Versus is in real time, like a sporting event. And what's great about watching a sporting event and tweeting about it is like watching Scandal and tweeting about it. It's on at the same time all over the world. So if you're in New York or LA, it's different times, but it's still the same show and you're still using social media to access it. On can do that same thing on like Netflix and Amazon. Those are like watching content on an airplane next to your friend. You push start at a slightly different time, and that means you'll laugh at a slightly different time or flinch at a slightly different time. It's just not the same as a theater experience. We can offer you the theater experience. And that's when people are also sharing on social media while they're watching, that's hugely advantageous. So Brookshire has empowered me to create, you know, a slate of stuff, a slate of events with him that exploit that ability of On. So I'm really excited to get that content out. So that's some of the stuff, some more grown partnerships with subscription companies and some new partners of mine, content creators that I work with. Some of the shows that I'm on, we're hoping that we can steer some of those over, entice and coax some of those over to On eventually, and nice. Have some more playing for the home team. So you know, those are some of the things that I'm working on, as well as myself appearing in some other shows. This is a show that streams on. And so it's a blessing to be on this. Right. And there's another series that I won't announce just yet until we put out the press release that I will be appearing on, that's an On original.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and so a monogamy, right? I want to ask, what was one of your favorite scenes, okay, from the past season?
I mean, again, I don't watch any of my content. We had this
chat. I know you don't watch it. Yeah, I want to talk about that first.
Off the shooting. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we mentioned that before. Okay, so I definitely want to discover this a little bit more. So you don't watch any of your performances, right? What is your number one reason for doing so, or for not doing so? I should say. why do you not want to do it?
Well, the original reason was, like I said, my first really big things were Me and Mrs. Jones. I didn't mention that. That was my first lead before Moesha, or like during Moesha, with Ed Laborde and Dwayne Wiggins, opposite Kim Fields, and then Redemption, and then that movie Twa. And in all three cases, those three directors were incredible. The guy in Redemption was the guy that wrote Hustle, the writer I was talking about, Sean Reed, who works with On now, was the director. His dad, Bob Reed, was the president of the Africa Channel. And Sylvain was my third director, with Ed my first. When I worked with Sylvain, that's Luc Besson's protege. Still to this day, I've never worked with anybody that's more technically advanced than him. And, I've worked with Bryan Singer, I've worked with a lot of guys, Ryan Wilson, you know, these are, Ryan Johnson, excuse me, these are Star Trek and, you know, Lopper and
right.
And Sylvain's that category of director. So the humble factor, you know, when you work around those guys, plays a lot into everything else that you do after. And, hold on a second, these earbuds are bothering me and I can hear you anyway. But that had a lot to do with everything that came after and wanting to study up and become more like them in every way.
Gotcha. And so it's more
not watching was an appreciation factor more so, because in the first movie that I did with Sylvain, it was all about being sexy, and I had already modeled and stuff like that, so I knew what I thought looked good and everything, but I the emotional parts of that movie, I didn't really know how to do as an actor when I was doing that, except for being natural. So it was, and being natural is not natural. And so I was still learning as an actor, and that was really, I had no business watching myself. I had to listen to Sylvain to even try to do a good job. You know, I had written some of the words. He empowered me to come in and be a creative on the story, but then I had to execute the story. And at that point, you know, I had no knowledge of directing. And film language, and I hadn't taken enough classes yet, and I felt just like I did as a football player playing for Bill Parcells or my college coach. I don't know as much as you, so I have to listen, and they'd be like, well, I'm watching the film, you go over there and really work really hard on these three things, and I'll tell you when you got them. And so, you know, I stopped watching from that day on because I trusted him, and I didn't ever have a reason to come over to that monitor, and it made me self-aware. In football, I had a really vast technique. I'd been playing since I was six. I knew the foot position was supposed to be this way. I was looking for my 45 degree angle on my hips. I was looking for this or that. And I'd watch film and go, ah, I'm at 47. I need to drop. Ah, I didn't drive my knee. I was looking for those things. Right. I knew already I didn't have that language. I didn't have enough classes. So why do I need to watch the film? I need to listen to the coach.
Wow.
I just never watched film. And I got into a Shakespeare class that first year and started doing plays every year because I met a lot of actors in my first year, and I never met an actor I thought was any good that wasn't a theater actor or wasn't doing theater after, like, Denzel. You know, that's why Russell Hornsby and Viola Davis, it's because for 20 years they're doing Fences with them, and it took 20 years for them to finally get that big movie role. That's the,
right.
You know, I'm the best actor on earth, Russell Hornsby or Viola Davis, that it takes that much not screen time next to an actor like Denzel to get all the screen time later. And now Russell's playing in The Bone Collector and Viola's, you know, Shonda's Muse. And that's why, because they're best of the best of the best, and they prove it the right way. And so I wanted to do that for myself and realize that watching myself and seeing what looks good has nothing to do with what is good, and unless I'm directing everybody in the piece.
Right. And it's very subjective anyway. And it's just crazy that, yeah, it's cool how you brought the, you know, kind of the sports aspect to the art aspect of acting. And
it's the same thing, man.
As far as looking at yourself on camera.
It's the same thing. I think every athlete watches film. I think every fighter, especially football players, part of our day is film study.
Yeah.
If you're a director, that's all you want to study. You are creating the films, the cinematographer. You seldom see the best directors that also act. Jodie Foster, if she's not directing, Ben Affleck, if they're not directing, and you can't direct better than them, but if they're not directing, they're not going to go in the tent. They're going to stand by the tent and wait for the director that's helping them be their best as an actor or actress come out and give them the notes, because everything else makes you hypercritical of looks, not knowing what's real about it. You know, the look is the director's idea. You think the shot's too smoky. What are you looking at the atmosphere for in a shot about you, you know, having an emotional reaction to your kid? That's distracted. That's the scene's messed up because you weren't acting as well as you should, because you were looking at the smoke in the air, which is my job. That's why I don't watch shots when I'm acting.
So premieres, things like that, did you attend? You watch those, or you kind of just step out, so you kind of do your own thing, or what?
Three examples. The Family Stone, you know, you go in with Sarah Jessica and Diane Keaton and Rachel McAdams and whoever, and you sit down, and then as soon as the lights go out, you go to the bathroom and hit the bar. On the yard, the lights go out, you go to the bathroom and hit the bar. Or a plate of food. I've never, you know, you go in so the people can see you sit down, you leave. As soon as the lights go off, or I do, and then as soon as they escort you back 5 minutes before the lights come back on, so that everybody can clap and you can stand up and have a social event and leave and do all that stuff. But I've never sat through the movie.
Wow, that's incredible. So you've been in, you've been in the industry for some time, and from what would you say one of the biggest things as far as like, you know, black in the black community, film, television, where have we come? Like the progress, obviously there's a lot of progress, but where do you think we're headed, especially after all of this, the pandemic, where do you think, so to speak, quote unquote, Black Hollywood is headed?
Well, I don't think there is such a thing as any delineation in Hollywood. I think it's one machine.
Yes. You know,
especially as the budgets come down, it effectively becomes a global market even more so than it already was. You know, if the range in budgets is only between $150,000 and $750,000 that are being made, anything below that is considered low quality. Anything above that is considered too expensive to be pragmatic for larger distributors, including Netflix. And Netflix makes $100 million movies, or they used to. So, you know, if they're going to make Blue again for Will Smith, it's not going to be for $100 million because they can't capture that much money on a stream without touring Will around and doing the traditional marketing patterns that they used to be able to do with a superstar like Will Smith. You know, The Rock, right. The Rock's value is that maybe on Monday night he's going to do Raw.
Right.
And yeah. If you don't have the 100 million eyeballs on a Monday night to feed whatever they're going to promote on Friday night opening, that's a different model. And that's what we're seeing now. And that allows On to compete directly with the big giants. And it allows the quality movies in that $500,000 to $750,000 range that, let's say, theater companies or Black-run companies like I Am Global are making right now in the theatrical Glendon Palmer, there are going to be a lot more of those because, you know, smart money makes money and you don't need a lot of money to make great movies. Digital's changed a lot. The camera packages have changed a lot. What you can do in post has changed a lot. And the fact that anybody that's been paying attention to how George Clooney's been making movies since he won his Oscar for Good Night and Good Luck, which he took $65,000 for and a big equity piece, realize how smart people make their movies. They don't pay their stars. They say, be our partners. The budget comes in at what we're talking about, and those movies still make $500 million and win Oscars. It's better for everybody. And that's what we're going to see, I think. And that plays into the favor of people like Jordan Peele and, you know, Sylvain White and other Ty Hodges, who's another actor director who's got some stuff out that are just incredible technicians and talents, but do everything smart at good, responsible budgets and with people who sell themselves as equity partners. And you know, you can replicate a studio model without spending $100 million, and that's the future, I think.
For sure. One last, I want to talk about, before we wrap the interview up, I wanted to discuss Snap Call, okay? So let's talk about the birth of Snap Call and what exactly your purpose is for this platform.
All right, well, I'm going to read Amadeo's quote. Snap Call is not a social media platform with broad social postings. It's focused on creating the personal connections required to properly network. That encapsulates what I've been doing over 20 years as an actor, using the leverage of being a former NFL and professional lacrosse player and the son of my dad and yada, 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 is leveraging all that to create these personal connections that now you can properly network. What SnapCall does is it allows the bottom billionth, the army of one, the hustle economy, which is every American, 85 million plus people, multiple billions of dollar marketplace where we have side jobs. And more than half of us aren't supposed to because of our day job. Our full-time job doesn't want you to have a side job. And social media is set up for that economy and to keep you in that economy. Example, LinkedIn. If you have a side hustle, you can't link that to your main job that's posted on your LinkedIn page. You're not going to know about it. You know, some of my partners in SnapCall can't even be listed. You know, that's funny. But you know, after we get everybody else on SnapCall, that won't be a problem anymore. And that's what the solution is. You know, we know that Donald Trump has 15 jobs. Some of them he won't report. You know, Bezos isn't only going to Amazon to make his wealth. Yet if Bezos' employees that were full-time were doing something else on the side, they wouldn't be allowed to be like Bezos and have those two jobs. That's what SnapCall does. It's a new way to connect, engage, and consume in this brave new world. And you can find out information on all of my social media platforms. You can join our wait list below my name on any way you might follow me, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever. Click that button. It'll take you to a wait list. But before you go to the wait list, you'll read our hustler stories, which are Dr. Chris Nocera, why his journey to becoming with SnapCall. He's former Cambridge Analytica. Hicked me to where the data is going, guys. Mm-hmm. how Donald Trump got in office. Cambridge Analytica is Facebook's partner, got in a lot of trouble. Chris worked for them. Now he works for Snapcall, giving the power back. Harvard PhD. Andy McDonald, our CFO, his hustle story is linked on all my pages. My fraternity brother from Dartmouth went out and did huge things in the tech world. It's now helping me make sure that Snapcall's put in your hands. It's again about the bottom billionth. I made this company because I was a guy from Boston trying to make it in LA and turn myself from the bottom billionth into the president of a streaming company. Hey, we did it. So, you know, I took the notes and I want you guys to have every step in the staircase mapped out before you start climbing, because that's the scary part. And that's what Snapcall provided.
Yeah, for sure. That first step can be terrifying, for sure. That's dope, man. Awesome. So inspiring, so motivating. So we have, I want to do fast questions real quick. Okay. Let me wrap this up. So I'm going to ask you five questions. Okay. You're going to give me the first answer that pops in your head. Okay. All right. You ready? Mm-hmm. All right. What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound?
Yes. Yeah.
My wife snoring.
Oh, really?
Oh, she snores very, very, very light. And instantly, really? But it means she's next to me. And I travel a lot. And that's like my comfort food.
That's awesome. Wow. I never heard
that. Well, she's with me, and that's a good thing, man. That's why I married her.
Okay. What is your favorite word?
Wow. Freedom.
Nice.
Spelled this way.
Spelled that way.
It means a lot.
It's easy now.
Freedom. To do what you want to do, and that's what this whole game is about. Some people have that power and luxury, and some people don't, and more people should. If there's one thing that I could say all of my companies are about, it's about freedom. That's on Snapcall, Black Freedom. Anything I'm about is about liberation for the individual.
If you could change lives of one person,
I'm God made me who I am for a reason, so I wouldn't change. I don't think he makes mistakes, so I'm supposed to be here to finish what I started, so I'll stay where I'm at.
Okay. Who is someone that you would love to work with that you haven't worked with yet?
That's a tough question. I mean, I just think Denzel is the best. And I'd love to
work. That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah, I mean,
technician I've ever seen
in
the right role. You know, I wouldn't want to be in a small
role. In the right role, of course.
I wouldn't want to be in a small role opposite Denzel. He just chews up the screen too much. If I was forced to be in a situation where it was a fair fight and I got to, you know, do some real heavy lifting against a king like that, I think it could only make me evolve and you know, like playing against the boxing against a better boxer, playing against a football player who has a better technique than you. Yeah. I have to just play and throw it all away. That always in my life made me a better dancer, a better athlete, a better, you know, whatever it is. And when I think of somebody that I, you know, admire that much in every aspect of his game, it's Denzel. So that would be the one.
Of course. All right. And last but not least, you get to heaven, see God. What would you like him to say to you?
Excuse me, I didn't hear your question. I get to God and?
We do. And what would you like him to say to you?
Your seat's ready, and it's right between my granddaddy and my daddy.
Nice. That's a great way to end it. Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for joining me. I had an amazing time talking to you. Can you tell everyone where to find you on social media and all that good stuff?
One-stop shop, brianwhiteonline.com. That's my personal website. That links to everywhere, including on and this show through Snapcall. So it's all
sure. And continue to watch Brian on Monogamy and Howard High and Bronx SIU. All that good stuff is coming out. You got a lot going on. I'm gonna stay watching on you and learn. Okay. Because that's where I'm trying to be. Thank you so much for joining me again, folks. You can find me everywhere at I Am Danny Royce. Please tune in next week. We'll see you same place, same time, inside Black Actors. Take care.
On behalf of our BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Check out our Black Hollywood Live YouTube page for even more great programming and amazing content. And be sure to subscribe and like our channel when you do. I'm your BHL host, Nakia Monet, and you can find me on all social media at Kiki Boom Boom or at Black Hollywood Live. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.